The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're back at Ed Stone, broadcasting live from our campus in the Midlands of the United Kingdom, right here in the middle of England. And as many of you know, I was in Edmond, Oklahoma, for the last couple of weeks in the lead up to the new semester. And now we're back, as I say, and we're back in the new studio. And I can hear every little thing I do on this microphone, so I'm standing as quietly as I can so that I don't rub or brush my papers or breathe too heavy or whatever it might be. But hopefully the sound is coming through loud and clear and as normal as ever for those of you listening in around the world. Instead of being down in the basement, hunkered down in the bunker, we're up in the attic. Or the loft, the eye in the sky. We need to come up with a new nickname for this studio up in the loft. Something like the Eagle's Nest, but that was for Hitler's hideaway. So we've got to come up with something a little bit different than that. But if you have any ideas, send me some emails and let me know what you think we ought to name this this little studio of ours. There's definitely more space. It's more comfortable. We had a massive fly that was just in here. We got rid of that. And so hopefully there won't be any other disruptions. And as I say, the broadcast will come through loud and clear. Well, as I said, I was in Edmond for the start of the new semester at God's College. And of course, we have a new semester beginning here as well. In Ed Stone, I think we have 15 total students going into the Ed Stone semester. And as I was asking them on a Friday night dinner we had, we only had five of those students here at Ed Stone last orientation. So it really is a very new and different feel. It's a great bunch for sure, but we are having quite a changeover with so many new students here on campus, and really the biggest group that we've had thus far, 15 students together with all the faculty members and graduates that work here at the Ed Stone campus. The students are already getting into the swing of things, not only with school, but visiting a few of the closer sites. I think all of them yesterday went to Blenheim Palace, which is just, 35, 40 miles down the M40 toward London. That, of course, is where Winston Churchill was born, and also where he proposed to his wife Clementine. And I was reminded this morning, one of the students brought out this famous quip by Churchill, who said, "At Blenheim, I took two very important decisions, to be born and to marry. I'm content with the decision I took on both occasions." So that's from Winston Churchill. And at Blenheim Palace, by the way, there's a wonderful museum or exhibit, I think, that's on permanent display there, about Winston Churchill and his life. So if you do ever visit the UK, that's definitely a place to see. I've been there a couple of times, and then more recently, as I mentioned on the radio, we saw Chartwell, the estate just south of London. So lots of history in and around London, lots of history in and around Ed Stone as well. So we're off and running on, while the students were at Blenheim, my wife and I, my son, we were all spending the better part of yesterday, well, recovering some from the jet lag. It was a slower day for us, but it was also quite busy as we were doing everything that we could to just try to get organized for the semester ahead. In many ways, today's classes felt like the first day of class, even though the actual first day was last Wednesday, but it's just been such a whirlwind of activity at Edmond and here and with all the travel that today, for the first time, it felt like we were settled in and getting into my Epistles of Paul class earlier this morning. And it's very exciting, as always, to think about the new school year and all of the activities coming up, the fall festivals. And then two or three weeks after the fall festivals, as I mentioned last week on the radio, we have the London PAC. We're in discussions today, this morning, trying to finalize the details for the venue that we're going to select for that that PAC appearance, or those two lectures that we'll give down in London to our trumpet readers. And as soon as we decide on the venue, then we'll be sending out those invitations and hope that we get a nice showing at the London PAC, the personal appearance campaign, after the feast. So we'll certainly keep you posted on some of those details. And of course, right now, over on the other side of the pond, you've got the Phoenix PAC going on. My father, I believe, would have spoken last night for the opening lecture, and then there's another one going tonight. No statistics have been emailed to me yet on the success of that PAC, but we'll let you know later on this week about the results that come out from Phoenix. Well, on today's program, a little bit later on, I was going through Daniel 8, well, actually, the Daniel Unsealed at Last booklet, in particular, yesterday, I slowed down into the eighth chapter of Daniel, and so we'll go through some of those verses for our study coming up in the next segment. Hopefully, you can stay tuned for that. I was told, by the way, over the weekend, one of our listeners said that he listens to the first 30 or 35 minutes of the program. This is while he's exercising. So he told me on Saturday, make sure that you put all the good material into the first 35 minutes. So I'll do my best to squeeze in as much as possible in these first 35 minutes. But as it's been going, the last half of the program has been pretty much the Bible study portion of the show, whereas the first half is devoted usually, not always, but usually to current events and prophetic events. So I guess depending upon what you prefer, either the best or the worst is in the first half hour of the show. I'll begin the news segment here with something my father wrote just in the latest Trumpet magazine. This is the September issue. And, of course, this is based upon that Key of David program that he gave a few weeks back on Germany and Russia's secret war against America. And my father says, do you really see what's happening in Europe? Do you see the stage being set for a world war like never before? And that's what we'll dwell on here in this first segment. I mean, seeing what's happening, not just in Europe, but in all of the world. We'll focus a little bit more on China here in just a second. But, of course, with respect to this article, as he's talking about this secret pact between Germany and Russia, well, the Nord Stream 2 is not so secret anymore, but who knows what else they've agreed to over the years. And my father's been talking about it. We're going to spend more time on this later this week. We're coming up to the anniversary, this Thursday, the anniversary of the Hitler-Stalin Pact 79 years ago, this so-called non-aggression pact that led to World War II. Within weeks of signing this agreement, Germany and Russia waged war against Poland first. They carved up Poland, and then, of course, it triggered World War II. My father says in this article, history shows that in between wars, Germany and Russia often work together. That's what we're seeing. Richard Palmer's had an article recently, too, about this love-hate relationship. When they come together, when they look like they're coming together in love toward one another, you better watch out. That's what history teaches us. Do you see what's happening? Do we see what's developing in front of our eyes? God spells it out for us, my father wrote. We can see events lining up with his prophecies. Anyone can see it, he wrote. Anyone. If you're watching, if you're looking, GermanForeignPolicy.com had an article just today talking about the German-Russian collusion. It'd be nice if some of the Western journalists would wake up for a moment and stop searching for collusion where there is none, because where there is collusion between Germany and Russia, I mean, that's what's dangerous here. Like I said, my father's written on this, Richard Palmer, in his article, Germany and Russia plotted a secret war for years. You remember that radio show he did a couple weeks back, where he just took you through centuries, in fact, centuries of history. Well, it's not just Russia strengthening ties with Germany behind the scenes. There was another article in the stack of news today about President Putin cozying up to Austria as well. Austria is headed up by a strong man, Sebastian Kurz. And you may have seen reports of President Putin attending the wedding. I forget, one of the foreign ministers or whatever, this lady that got married. And here comes Putin showing up at the wedding. And of course, Austria, they're really calling on Europe to remove any sanctions aimed at Russia. So what happens when Russia reaches out to the Germans and the Austrians? We're seeing it happen. Like my father asks in the article, do you really see what's happening in Europe? What about in Russia? Putin's war games factory. This is a piece from the Daily Mail. How they're in the final stages of assembling a new generation of supersonic strike bombers. It's quite an upgrade over the ones that they've been using in Syria. It says the new planes can be navigated up to 8 times better than the previous generation and target their improved missiles up to 10 times more accurately. And so here, I mean, like Richard brings out in his article, this one on, what has just happened historically. You know, we like to fool ourselves into thinking that every nation's out there and they just want peace. But what does history reveal about the real world in which we live? It reveals that nations are, they want power. They want influence. They want wealth. And history has shown over and over again that they're willing to go to war to obtain it. And we're facing one more world war. That's what your Bible prophesies. Great Tribulation, it's called. And so you see all of these secret alliances, so many of them anti-American. America is supposedly the sole superpower. And yet these other ascendant powers, I mean, they're mobilizing their forces. They're expanding their arsenals. They're entering into alliances in opposition to the United States. This one here from the AFP, Chinese bombers, they're likely being trained for U.S. strikes. That's from the Pentagon. The annual report to Congress, released Thursday, this is from last week, highlights China's growing military, economic, and diplomatic clout, and how Beijing is leveraging this to rapidly build its international footprint and establish regional dominance. Well, I mean, it even goes beyond the region of China and the South China Sea. As I'll bring out in just a moment here. But, I mean, here is China's growing military, and it's expanding its economic and diplomatic clout all over the world. Fears over Pacific debt colonies as Tonga struggles to repay China. This is another story from the Times. It says here, fears that China is using loans as leverage over Pacific nations to expand its military footprint have sharpened after the island state of Tonga admitted it was in debt distress. So you know all about China building these military installations in the South China Sea, expanding its sphere of influence. And here are these little colonies that they owe a lot of money to China. I mean, this is just like a little foretaste of what's coming to the United States. The United States owes something like, what is it, $2 trillion to China? What happens? What happens when the United States goes under economically and can't pay those bills? Well, look at the little case of Tonga. I mean, nobody cares about Tonga. I understand that. It's just a little country. What's the big deal? How can it compete with China? But this is a little sample of what's coming on a much larger scale. It says critics say that credit extended by Beijing and by Chinese state banks to impoverished developing nations with limited ability to repay them constitutes a form of debt colonialism. I mean, in other words, China's going in and they're offering these loans, and then these little impoverished nations, they can't pay anything back. And so China just helps itself to their ports. or to whatever it is that they have of value, whatever is of strategic importance. It says here, debt colonialism, and is a pretext to advance China's wider strategic aims, including new bases, allowing it to project military power deep into the South Pacific. See, they're using their economic might, when compared to Tonga, of course, to expand its military presence. It says Tonga's prime minister said yesterday that he was concerned that Beijing was preparing to seize assets in exchange for unpaid debts, and urged neighboring Pacific countries that also owe money to band together and to press for loans to be written off. Well, in the case of Tonga, I think they've borrowed something like $116 million. And this is just a tiny little nation of 109,000 people. These loans, what they owe China, it's more than a quarter of its GDP. And so what's China going to get in return? Well, they're just going to take what they want. Reuters, this is another piece here. It says empty hotel rooms, idle tour boats, and shuttered travel agencies reveal widening fissures in the tiny Pacific nation of Palau, which is caught in an escalating diplomatic tug of war between China and Taiwan. And so China doesn't like the way, it doesn't like the position that Palau takes, and so they basically ban their people from visiting the island nation. And of course, that little island nation relies on tourism to survive. So here is China using tourism, or enforcing a lack of tourism. It's using it as a weapon. It's like Richard said in that recent article. I mean, we like to think, every nation wants to get along with other nations. We all want to help each other. We all want to sit down and try to bring peace to regions. But what does the real world reveal time and time again? Nations like China, they're expanding their military, their impact, their influence. They want more power, and so does Russia, and so does Germany. Richard Palmer has an article coming out in the Trumpet soon about China's voracious appetite for sea gates. It's moving all over the world, just devouring, just similar to these stories I just read to you. Moving in there and then taking advantage of the situation when it goes bad for the host country. He's got all kinds of examples coming up in this Trumpet article. You can look for that at thetrumpet.com real soon. Sri Lanka. China's invested something like $15 billion in Sri Lanka's infrastructure. And just like in the case of Tonga, Sri Lanka's had to borrow a lot of money to refurbish one of its key port facilities. And now, like Tonga, they can't pay it back. So a few months ago, China just basically took control of the port. China runs the port on a 99-year lease. It's China's now. These are sea gates. I mean, this is prophesied in your Bible. God said that Israel, the end-time nations of Israel, would gain control of all of the prominent sea gates in the world. And now we see the United States and Britain losing control of all of those sea gates, and these ascendant powers like China, they're devouring them. Djibouti may be the next one to go the way of Sri Lanka. I mean, that's a country sitting right at this crucial passageway, the Bab el Mandeb Strait. I mean, you've heard it talked about before on this program and on Trumpet Hour with Brent Noctegal. Djibouti now has debts equal to about 90% of the size of its economy. It can't pay it back. It can't pay China back. Foreign Policy asks, will Djibouti become the latest country to fall into China's debt trap? That's what it is. It's a debt trap, and China knows it. It's a good trade-off for China. They go in knowing these nations aren't going to pay back the money, and so China just helps itself. to all of these critical sea gates. China's Djibouti, I think we've reported before, it's the site of China's first overseas military base. And it also happens to host America's only permanent base in Africa. Where is this leading? As China gains more and more control of Djibouti, what does this mean for America's base? Well, you can go right down the list. Pakistan also. There's a Chinese military base. For the most part, I mean, that's effectively what it is in Pakistan because, again, China's poured all this money, this infrastructure funding into these key deep water ports. And then they just help themselves to it. The Maldives, same thing. China's expressed interest in building a port in the Maldives. That's according to the South China Post. And the Maldives are already allowing the Chinese ships to dock there and such. Here again, the Maldives, they owe most of their debt. Most of their debt, it's been extended to them from China. Another, I think this is an island, Vanuatu, taking out huge loans to build up a wharf. And this is closer to Australia. And of course, this has the Australian authorities nervous because of this rising superpower. One commentator is quoted as saying, that's going to have warships sailing right near Australia's doorstep. It's happening all over the world. Latin America, everyone knows about the Panama Canal. That's America's most important sea gate. But did you know that China controls the ports at both ends of that canal? China does. And so you think, oh, well, these aren't really that significant, these developments. But China's just gobbling up all of these port facilities around the world, even the Panama Canal. It's investing in Brazil's ports. It's happening in Europe. There's a port in Greece. That China's taking advantage of those nations in Europe that are also struggling financially. It holds something like 70% of the stake in a port, the Piraeus port in Greece. Again, Richard said, we like to convince ourselves that everyone wants peace and all nations just want to get along. But history, and of course we know a lot because of prophecy as well, we could add, but history, even history reveals to us the real world. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, broadcasting in our brand new perch in the loft at Edstone. You can email the program at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. America's status as the world's lone superpower is rapidly fading. Other nations and groups of nations are angling to fill the void. Rising in the East is an emerging power block of tremendous potential in manpower, economic heft, and military might. Its growing presence is intensifying global competition for resources and for geopolitical influence. Where will this trend lead? What does this mean for you? Biblical prophecy provides a remarkable, penetrating preview of Asia's future. Request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. This book exposes in startling detail what Russia and China are doing and will do, and how they will affect your life. Also, you'll be sent a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet looks at today's headlines through the clear light of Bible prophecy. The Trumpet will keep you up to date on the continuing rise of the powers in the East by taking a hard look at today's news and comparing it to the prophecies of the Bible. The Trumpet Magazine is this world's most informed news magazine. To learn more, request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Act today and request Russia and China in Prophecy. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
So evidently, the echoey sound that I'm picking up in my earphones is also going out to you, the dear listener. Our wonderful producer informs me. And that's because we haven't quite finished the studio here with all of the necessary soundproofing. So for the next few programs, we'll probably have a little bit more of that echoey sound. I guess in some ways it sounds like reverb in the recording studio. So it's not so bad. We'll get used to it. But hopefully, as I said at the start of the show, the sound is coming through nice and clear because we certainly want to keep that going. So Daniel 8. My father gave, he's probably given several programs on the subject of Daniel 8. And you know about the booklet, Daniel Unsealed at Last. But this program from 2015, I think it was, here's my father basically discussing or pointing out how that the book, of course, and this chapter is prophetic, and it's for primarily for our time today. Here's clip one.
There's one dual prophecy that will show you that, or actually one scripture, Daniel 8 and verse 12, that I want to discuss today, and it is a dual prophecy. If you look at Daniel 12, verses 4 and 9, it says that Daniel, the book of Daniel, is only for this end time. It's only for today.
That's from Daniel 12. He's referencing about how that it's for the end time. And if you look specifically at Daniel 8 and verse 26, in the Moffat translation, it says that this prophecy is something that relates to the far future. It's for the far future. Verse 17 in Daniel 8 says that it's a vision for the time of the end. That's the Revised Standard Version. The time of the end, or the far future. Our time today, in other words. Let's pick up our study then at the start of the chapter. This is Daniel 8 and verse 1. Notice this. It says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, Daniel, he's speaking here, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. So Daniel wrote this prophecy sometime around 550 BC in the third year of Belshazzar's reign, as we read there. And it says in verse 3, then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. So what is the meaning here? Daniel standing here and seeing this ram and the two horns and such. Well, if you drop down to verse 20, you see the Bible interpreting itself. It says in verse 20, the ram which you saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. So Daniel lived during the time of the Babylonian Empire. And he also lived into the beginning stages of Media Persia, or the Medo-Persian Empire, that went on to rule for about two centuries after Daniel's death. It ruled up through 331 BC. So back up to verse 5 and just consider this prophecy. I mean, leaving aside the verses that we're maybe more familiar with down in verses 11, 12, 13, and 14, and then of course the Daniel 8 man at the end of the chapter, but just looking at the prophecy more broadly, you know, the four great kingdoms, like in Daniel 2, that Daniel 2 image, there's a section in the Daniel Unsealed booklet about that Daniel 2, which gives us the basic framework of prophecy. And here at the start of chapter 8, you're reading or you're seeing the prophecy regarding a couple of those kingdoms. So back to verse 5, it says, "And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes." So here comes a goat with a notable horn. What does this represent? Well, looking at the interpretation found in this same chapter, it says, "And the rough goat is the king of Grisha, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king." So here then is the Greco-Macedonian Empire, the king of Grisha, and the notable horn is the first king, the Bible says. That would be Alexander the Great. So after Babylon, then it was Medo-Persia, and then thirdly, Alexander's empire overwhelmed the Medo-Persians in 331 BC. All of this prophesied centuries in advance of it actually happening. No wonder the skeptics like to say, oh, Daniel was written by some Jew centuries later than what it actually says. He couldn't have known all this in advance. He did know it all in advance, or at least he recorded it. Most of it he didn't understand. He lamented that fact. And God said, don't worry, go your way, Daniel. These words are meant to be understood in the last time, in the last days. It's for a time far into the future. But look at how accurate these prophecies are. Verse 8, backing up again, it says, "Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and in its place came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." What an accurate description of Alexander's strong, albeit short, reign. When he was strong, the great horn was broken, right at the height of his power, just in his early 30s. Alexander the Great. And then he suddenly dies from a fever, just at the tender age of 33. Verse 22 explains, "Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power." So after Alexander died, this was around 323 BC, his kingdom was divided up into four parts, and none of them were as strong as Alexander's empire. But here again, just keep in mind the time sequence. Daniel's getting the vision in 550 BC when the Babylonian Empire ruled. It was destroyed in 539 BC by the Medo-Persians. And then they were then crushed 2 centuries later by the Grecians, 331 BC. Alexander died in 323. You just follow the progression, and then, of course, what you get in the rest of the prophecy, I mean, it couldn't have been fulfilled before 323. It's after that. And then you look at those verses that I read at the start, Daniel 8, verse 17, Daniel 8, verse 26. It's for the last days. It's for the time of the end. So this gives us a pretty nice overview coming into these scriptures that we might be a little more familiar with. Verse 9, it says, "And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land." This is not to be confused with the little horn of Daniel 7 and verse 8. This is talking about a little horn that springs up out of one of the four horns from Alexander's empire. And like my father brings out in the Daniel booklet, you can look into some of the better, older commentaries, and they, for the most part, they get it right on this little horn of Daniel 8 and verse 9. It's referring to Antiochus Epiphanes, who came up out of the four divisions of Greece. He came up from Egypt, bridged the gap between the Greco-Macedonian Empire and then what would be the fourth and final world empire, the Roman Empire. And so with the collapse of the Grecian Empire, you had this ruthless dictator referred to specifically in Daniel 8, coming into Palestine in 176 BC, and then setting up an abomination of desolation, the Bible calls it. He pillaged and desecrated the Jews' temple in Jerusalem. Let me see read what Greek historian Polybius, he had to say regarding this Antiochus. He despoiled most sanctuaries. He laid heavy burdens and taxes on the Jewish people as well. It says in Werner Keller's book, The Bible as History, throughout the turbulent changes of its past history, Israel had been spared none of the horror and ignominy which could befall a nation, but never before, neither under the Assyrians nor under the Babylonians, had it received such a blow as the edict issued by Antiochus Epiphanes, by which he hoped to crush and destroy the faith of Israel. That was his aim. And of course, there's history there. As I say, from 176 to around about 168 BC. But more significant than this history, much more significant than this history, is the fact that this is prophecy. There's duality here. There would be an end time Antiochus. Well, actually, more than one. But one that would come inside of God's church and destroy the faith of God's people. You look at, what's prophesied here in Daniel, but also in the Gospels. Jesus spoke of the abomination of desolation. We've seen it happen in the church, God's church. We've seen it happen during an Antiochus administration in the United States. And of course, there's another one coming on the scene out of Europe. And the path that either of these Antiochus's leave, I mean, the path is destruction, abomination. We'll focus more on what's happened in the church. My father, of course, for more on these different Antiochuses, you've got the Daniel Unsealed booklet, and you've also got the America Under Attack booklet as well. Both of them would be essential for a study into this subject. Verse 10, it says, "And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them." This evil power stamping upon God's truth and God's work. Strong's Concordance says of this host, a mass of persons, especially organized for war, it says, yea, he magnified himself even against the prince of the host, that's Christ. And by him the daily was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. He's fighting Jesus Christ. He's fighting God's work. He's destroyed God's work. I mean, this really shows us where the Laodiceans failed, spectacularly so. They stopped doing God's work. When you stop doing God's work, you die as a church. If we don't put our hearts into the work of God, we die spiritually, individually, we'll die. You think about this in relation to 2 Thessalonians 2 and what it says about not letting any man deceive you. They're going to come trying to deceive you by any means. And then it refers to a specific leader in that prophecy in 2 Thessalonians 2, one who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he is as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. I mean, he's in charge. He knows more than God. He decides. Again, verse 11 says, he magnified himself to the prince of the host, and by him the daily was taken away. The work stopped, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. My father writes in his booklet, there are two great sins. The daily or work of God has been taken away by this evil man, and also the place of the sanctuary, the place where God's work was being done. was cast down. These are the two great evils of this Antiochus administration in God's church. Verse 12 continues, and an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and it prospered. I mean, this administration comes along and it just simply destroys everything in its path. It made the work of God's church, desolate. And you know about some of the other prophecies where we had to come along, God raised up another work that would raise the ruins, that would rebuild as in the days of old. But look at the destruction that was brought on. Why? Because of transgression, it says here. Sin is what brought it into the church. Sin is why so many people went along with this evil administration. Tens of thousands of God's people, something like 95% of God's people, falling away from the truth, being deceived by this man, by his evil administration. Well, the work just ground to a halt following the death of Herbert Armstrong in January of 1986. And it says here in verse 13, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto the certain saint which spoke, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? Again, looking at this spiritually. Looking at it spiritually, and here's this saint asking, how long will God's work be stopped? How long is it going to be cast to the ground? Well, not forever. We can thank God for that. There was a plan. There was a plan in the works, even as that changeover happened in 1986. Verse 14 says, and he said unto me, unto 2,300 days or sacrifices, that's what it means, evening and morning sacrifices, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. You can look at the Revised Standard Version to get the accurate translation. 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices, or in other words, 1,150 days. God said that at the end of 1,150 days, then the sanctuary would be cleansed. My father asks in the Daniel booklet, he asks that, and just putting together these numbers, you got to identify when Satan took away the daily or the work, stopped the work, and then when did it end? Well, it obviously stopped on January 16th, 1986. That's when Herbert Armstrong died. My father writes, this is from the booklet, shortly before his death in 1986, even though the work had grown abundantly for 7 years, Mr. Armstrong still perceived a liberal undercurrent within the church. He even said there were those who, like vultures, wanted him to die so that they could take over the church. And then on January 16th, 1986, Mr. Armstrong was taken out of the way. That's the way it's worded in 2 Thessalonians 2. On that day, the great spiritual war of Daniel 8 began. On that day, Satan began working mainly through one man, systematically dismantling and casting to the ground the truth that Mr. Armstrong had taught. So how long would it last? How long would this go on? Well, as the prophecy answers, for 1,150 days, from January 16th, 1986, and then moving ahead on the calendar, 1,150 days, it brings you to March 11th, 1989. And so March 11th, 1989, that marks the beginning of the sanctuary being cleansed. There is hope, in other words. Here's one more clip from my father's program back in 2015, clip 2.
But because of the sins of spiritual Israel, Antiochus was able to make inroads into God's church and even stop the work altogether for 1,150 days. And that's explained in our booklet on Daniel. And the good news is that all of this leads, I'm telling you, it leads directly into the second coming of Jesus Christ.
So that's the exciting thing about this prophecy. I mean, it was a dreadful time in 1986, 87, 88, 89 as people began to see what was happening in God's church. But then in 1989, March 11th, it begins. 4 months after that, I read Malachi's message, the first one to read it, July 16th, 1989. And there was the solution. God would raise up the ruins through his servant. God would rebuild the work through this mustard seed beginning. 1150 days. Now, continuing on, look at Daniel 8 and verses 18 and 19. You can see again in verse 17 that it's all for the time of the end. Verse 18 continues, "Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep, on my face toward the ground." I'd say it was a deep sleep. It says, "But he touched me and set me upright. And he said, 'Behold, I will make you know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. For at the time appointed, the end shall speak.'" The time appointed at the last end. That's talking about the 1150-day period. And that's now come and gone. I mean, that's now history. And all of this means that there's just not much time left. We're drawing near to the return of Christ. That's the exciting news here, where all this is leading. Notice verse 23, it says, "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up." So this brings us to the Daniel 8 man that's prophesied to emerge out of the heart of Europe. You see so many strongmen all over the world, even right now. The Prince of Rosh, the premier in China, the leader of Japan in many ways. I mean, Japan's about to change its constitution. This was discussed last week on Trumpet Hour. The constitution established after World War II in 1947 that basically is there to prevent Japan from ever militarizing itself again. And that's all about to change. Well, they're our ally now. And they've got to pay their fair share. That's what the Trump administration keeps saying, particularly to European nations. And so Germany, you need to step up and militarize your nation. Same with Japan. It's happening all over the world. And then you've got China, and you have Russia making all of these power grabs. Well, Germany too. You look at what happened in the Balkans in the 1990s. I mean, Europe's being carved up just like it happened in the lead up to World War II and during World War II. Germany's grabbing hold of the Balkans. Russia's reaching into Georgia as it did in 2008. Then Ukraine, Crimea, and all that. I mean, you do this and we'll get this. All of these secret deals and pacts. We'll talk more about that later this week, as I say. And then finally, it's going to explode in world war. That's what your Bible prophesies. That's what history informs us. That the latter time of their kingdom, when transgressors are come to a full, a king of fierce countenance is going to rise up. Rise up out of Europe. Verse 24 says, "And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people." Satan is the one behind this movement. Satan is the one who gives this man his understanding. It's not by his own human power. No, not by a long shot. And yet when this man appears, because he's backed by this evil power coming from the devil, he's going to destroy wonderfully. Nuclear weapons, that's what we're talking about here. So there's a much greater power at play than just human beings, as carnal and as sinful as we are of and by ourselves. But Satan's working behind the scenes. And this Satan-inspired man is going to lead a great false church, and also, well, we've seen that, and he's also, there's going to be an Antiochus type that rallies a united Europe, a strong man. Verse 25 says, and through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. See, he destroys many by peace. He says he wants peace. He acts like he wants peace, but he's lying. What he wants is to rule the world. That's the truth of your Bible. That's the truth of history. Just like that quote I keep giving you from Richard's article. I mean, we like to think, oh, all of us, we're here, we're at the negotiating table, everybody wants peace. In fact, what has been the way of man? Well, look at man's history. Look at what we've done to ourselves. Look at what we've done to other nations. Nations want power. Rulers of nations want power, and they're willing to go to war to get it. So you have all of the maneuvering that's going on right now, all of the strategizing. And then when this Satan-inspired man shows up, I mean, his will be a policy of craft or deceit. That's the way it's worded in the Revised Standard Version. Craft and deceit. A man of peace, quote unquote, fighting against the Prince of Peace, fighting against God and Jesus Christ. Verse 26 says, and the vision of the evening and morning. Here's the, again, we've read, we've established the context. The vision of the evening and the morning, which was told is true. There, wherefore, shut you up the vision, for it shall be for many days, or it's going to be for the last days, or as that the Moffat, I think it was, I read it earlier, it shall be far into the future. See, God wants us to understand. He wants us to see. What do you see? What do you see? My father wrote in the New Throne booklet. He asked Jeremiah, what do you see happening in Europe? Do you see it? God wants us to see that this world is about to explode into world war. Well, in the booklet, he talks about the fight that Daniel was engaged in just to get this message out. A message that he didn't even then understand. And my father says, if God did so much to help Daniel fight against Satan while this was being revealed, what kind of battle do you think we will face as God opens our minds to actually understand and proclaim this message? I mean, we understand it. We know the meaning. We know it's for our time. We can put personalities into some of these verses. God identifies the nations, the significant nations that are at play in these end time prophecies. My father said, Satan is raging mad right now. He's been cast down to this earth, and his sight is fixed on you, on your faith. How will you respond to his attack? Will you be like so many Laodiceans who have caved in to the pressure, or will you respond as Daniel did? So many of our brethren, our beloved brethren, have just collapsed under the pressure coming from the devil. They've caved into the pressure. They're going along, going with the flow, not taking a firm stand, not taking any kind of action, but instead just drifting along, which is exactly what Satan wants us to do. How will you respond to Satan's attack? Will you cave into the pressure, or will you respond like Daniel did? Well, the last bit here, it says, and I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. He was astonished at this vision. He didn't even understand it, though. But he really did respond in a righteous, God-fearing way. He fainted. He couldn't believe it. It talks later on in the book about Daniel's fasting. It also refers to Daniel understanding these prophecies by studying the books of the Bible. I mean, he was diligent in his spiritual studies. He cried out to God. I gave a program recently on the subject of prayer, taken right out of Daniel 6. I mean, this was a man of God, a great man of God. And that's how we want to respond to these tests, to this fight, to this warfare that we're engaged in. We want to respond the way that Daniel did. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're putting the finishing touches on our first, or at least my first, broadcast in the loft at beautiful Edstone, right here in the Midlands of England. You can email the program, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.